Good afternoon.
Welcome back. I've got the goal for today is to finish up the lecture from last time about compression and Huffman codes, and then to dive into parallel processing. I think we might be able to get through both of them, in which case that will free up the we're in the home stretch now, so that will free up the last class to just be a review. As long as I get the sample final to everybody before then, I'm hoping that that will be a useful way of making sure that everybody understands all the questions and so forth. The current plan for the final, which will probably be the final plan for the final, is to for it to be 20 questions, 10 just on the second half since the first midterm, and then 10 cumulative, so using questions from the midterm and also from the final. And since it's actually worth The way that I said that I would break down the grades in the beginning of the semester was 20% for quicker questions, 20% for homeworks, 20% for midterm, 20% for the first part of the final, and then 20% for the last part of the final. So that's how it'll break down. So those two parts, 10 questions each, are the same worth as the midterm was, which was also 10 questions. So it has a certain symmetry to it that way, I thought. Okay? I did notice that, that was a question.
What
day is the
final
going to
be?
I believe so. I put it on the schedule so because I forget things right away. So yeah, it looks like the 19th. And it'll be in this class, but at noon, not at our regular meeting time. So the final, Rutgers does the final schedule in this funky way. You have to look up and cross-reference and figure out which times on this campus correspond to times on the other campus. Anyway, I went through that process and it told me that it was noon to 3 p.m. Just, you know, here. Okay, we good? You can see now, we really are in the final stretch here. So we're in December now. Welcome to December. And this is the third. So we've got the third, the fifth, the 10th, and the 12th. The 12th is the last class. And at the moment, the way I had it, work through is the chapter 9. I would do all of chapter 9 and all the review on the last class. But if I can get through, there's not much more to say about chapter 6, and then if I can squeeze in almost all of chapter 7, then we'll do chapter 8 on Wednesday, chapter 9. No, wait, hang on. We'll do chapter 7 today, 8 on Wednesday, right, 9 the following Monday, and then review on the following Wednesday. And then there's nothing else I'll tell you after that, unless you ask. All right. So, good. We're good with that. One thing I noticed is that I had made this term, Google Seek Easy, that was supposed to be easy to find. I'm not sure if it was found when we did that demo, but it does seem to find it now. If you search for Google Seek Easy, you get a Google app. There's only one page that has it. It's the page bar. Just wanted to kind of, give you a sense of finality with that particular demo. All right, but that was the only thing I could think of to say. All right, so if we're good moving forward, then I think what I'll do... so I've got two clicker questions. The first one is something that I sort of maybe wanted to ask you earlier, but then I had gotten some clicker questions deleted by accident. So we'll do this one and talk about it, and then the second one is a compression question. And in the process of doing this, we might need to do one other example, but that should end the compression stuff. I also had some things in the notes about secret codes, sending messages and cryptography and stuff, because that's what's in the chapter in the book. He does talk about that a bit. But I never came up with a really good way of doing a demo of that, and I had no idea what to even ask you about it. Like, here, send me a secret code, and I won't be able to understand it. So anyway, I think I'm going to skip that. But he does write some nice stuff about it in the book, so I would encourage you to look at that. The other thing is, based on the schedule that I just showed you, chapters are happening like one per lecture until we're done. So you might want to just sit down and read the rest of the book if you haven't done so yet, and just get ahead of the curve that way. Okay, well, with that being said, I can turn this on. So let me see what this question was. All these problems except one can be solved faster on a sorted list than on an unsorted list. Which is the odd one out? Which is the one that having a sorted list doesn't make it any easier? And if you know the answer and you have some time to chill, think about what the big O notation answer would be for each of these, unsorted and sorted. Is this all of us? Is it 29 of us? Wow. Here's the other thing I was thinking. We should talk about like a secret word that one of the questions on the final will be, what was the secret word? And so you all just get that. And the people who listen to the lecture on the recording, they'll get it too. I have a feeling that there's some people who are in this third category of just blowing us off. And so I wouldn't mind if they don't get that right. Do you think we should do that?
Yes.
Yeah, you like that? All right. So, does anyone have a suggestion for what the magic word should be? I can't spell that.
E-O-O-M-O-S-H-I-G-I.
I can't spell that. Yeah?
Cheese.
Cheese. I like cheese. You like cheese?
I like cheese.
I like cheese, really. That's from a cartoon. Is that? No? All right. Cheese. Cheese. So just say cheese. So that should be like a 10-point question on the cumulative part of the final? All right. What should I put on the sample final for that question?
So cheese will be
on the final. Let me make a note of this because I have a tendency to forget things. So cheese is on the final. I'm looking for a Chinese. I spell cheese wrong. I can't spell that either. Final question, magic word. I have to put one on the sample final too. Did someone have something like that? Did you say peanut butter?
Yeah.
I like peanut butter too, actually. Peanut butter on sample final. I can say hint, it goes on bread. They both go on bread. All right, good. Now, meanwhile, we got one other person clicking. All right. I really appreciate that you guys are here. And I'm very frustrated that nobody else is here. All right, so that being said, all right, I will continue to bring my A game for you guys and, on everybody else. So let me stop this in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. And let's go through. I feel like I should ask this stuff on the final, too. All right. So we've got a list of N elements, an N long list. And if it's hard for you to think about that on short lists, because you can all answer these questions really quickly on a short list, imagine that it's 1,000 elements long, right? And so really, there's only four kinds of running times that you need to worry about. So let me say what those are. The first one is O of 1, or constant. This is the fastest time, and this basically says you've got a list of n elements, but you can just go and look and answer it immediately. So just look. No, that doesn't quite work. You know exactly where to look. And it's just basically one place or a small number of places. All right, the next one is O of log n. This is called logarithmic. All right, logarithmic means that what, basically that's what you get if you can split the list in half repeatedly until you're down to one element, and that's all you have to do. So just, you've got to look through, you look at one element, split the list in half. Look at another element, split the list in half again, and repeat that until you're all the way down to just one element. So repeated, look, and split. So this is the sort of thing you get if you're trying to look something up in a sorted list. This is called binary search. Because you start off, you look in the middle, and the middle tells you, is the thing you're looking for in the first half or the second half? So in the first half, you throw away the second half and just focus on the first half. You just keep repeating that until you find the one that you want. So that gets you a big O of log n. O of n is linear. And that means basically you have to look through the whole list once, or a constant number of times. Once or twice, that sort of thing. Yeah?
The card thing that you were doing, yes. That should be log n
when you... which part of the card thing? Sorting the whole list?
No, you took a number and you split it in half.
Right.
And then you take the pile that you need and then split that in half.
Right, so if... In what I demoed with the actual cards, I split, it's true, I took a card and then I split everything in half, then I dealt with one half, and then later I dealt with the other half.
Okay, but not...
Here, you look at one thing, you split it, and you never go back. That algorithm that I showed you was n times log of n. So it did have this log n part in it, but it also had another factor of n, because I had to look through the whole list repeatedly.
So that would be n log n?
That would end up being n log n, yeah. Which is, none of these are that. N log n comes up usually in somewhat complicated situations that I probably wouldn't expect you to just recognize. So don't worry so much about that. But this one comes up a lot, which is n squared, or quadratic. So that's when you have to look at all pairs of numbers. Or the other way this comes up is if you have to look through the whole list and then the whole list but one and the whole list but two, or so look at all pairs, or look through whole list, which is n, but you have to do it n times. That gets you n squared. Okay? So this is, all these boxes that we're about to look at are all filled in by one of these four choices. Either you know exactly where to look at the list and you're done. You know, you can look at a place in the list, and that lets you throw away half the list, and you repeat this until you're down to one element. That's log n. Linear basically means you have to scan through the whole list, and for each element in the list, you have to do a little bit of work. And n squared means you have to scan through the whole list, and then you have to scan through again, and you have to scan through again, and that happens n times. N times n is n squared. All right? So with these as our choices, let's look at what we get. Don't worry, the choices will be back momentarily. All right. So, if we're trying to find the number, we have a list of numbers, they're not sorted, they're not in any particular order, but we want to know, of all the things in the list, which one's closest to 100? Okay? So an unsorted list, finding out what's closest to 100, which of these categories would that be in? Is it something that we can just go right to the right element and say, oh, now I see? Is it something where we can look at one element and say, oh, we can throw away half the list? Is it something that we can do by looking through the entire list, each element one at a time? Or is it something where we can do by looking through the whole list, getting some partial answer, but then going through and doing it again and repeating that n times? So which does this feel most like? So who thinks O of 1, constant? Who thinks O of log n, logarithmic? Who thinks O of n, linear? Who thinks O of n squared, quadratic? All right. So I would agree that people didn't vote for O of 1 or O of log n in this case. I think that's good, because those are not the natural choices. The natural choices are the other two. But of these, how could you do it linearly? What do you actually have to do to the list to get the number that's closest to 100? So I've got 1,000 numbers lined up. What do you do? Is that going to be a hand, or you just flop it? All right. Yeah, go ahead.
go through the list, and as you're going through, start with one number.
Right.
Then you move to the next number.
Well, what do you do with the number that the first number?
You hold on to it.
Okay.
That's the linear.
Well, I see how. Yeah, it's going to end up being linear. But how do we? What we do is we look at that first number and we say, how close is this to 100?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Then we move on to the second one.
Then you say, how close is this to 100?
Good. And is it closer than the other one was? Yeah. All right. So you guys were popping up hands. Are you going to help me out? Go ahead.
Or I was just going to say that I think it's quadratic because regardless of how you go about looking at the list, you have to make a comparison. When you move to the second one, you have to say to yourself, is this closer to 100 than prior one?
Right, but what do we need to remember from the prior ones? Let's say that it's 1,000 elements. Let's say we're at the 500th element. One way we could check if this one's closer is by going and comparing it to everything previously. But another thing is we could just remember what was the best out of everything we've seen up to that point. So you're right, there's two different algorithms we could use, right? One algorithm says, as we're marching through the list, we get to a particular element, we say, okay, how close is this to 100? And is it closer than the first one was, the second one was, the third one was, the fourth one was? If you do that, you end up with a quadratic algorithm. That's exactly right. But that's not the best way to solve this problem. The best thing to do is you actually keep track of what's the best I've seen up to this point. And now I look at the new one, how close is this to 100? Is it closer than the best that I've seen up to this point? No? Then throw it away and move on to the next one. So we only have to do a little bit of work per element of the list. We basically just march through the whole list of 1,000 elements, and at the end, all that we've got left in our hand is just the best one. Can you see the difference between those two approaches? No. So how would you literally, if you had 1,000 numbers in front of you and you wanted to know which one was closest to 100, would you, you know, you're now at the 500, you're going to look through it one at a time, right? And for each of those, what are you going to do? So now you're at the 500th element, and the number is 211. Do you now go and compare it to everything that came before? Probably not. Probably you just kind of keep in your head what's the best I've seen so far.
Why is that linear as opposed
to quadratic? So it's linear because what we do is we just march through the list. You can imagine taking your finger and just running it through the list. And the amount of time that you spend on each element is about the same, no matter where you are in the list. It's not like you're running through this list and it's getting slower and slower and slower. Okay. Right? You just go, is it this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, this one? Oh, this one's better than everything I've seen before. Let's just keep that in mind, and we move on. Okay. So that ends up being linear. So this is over. We'll do a quadratic one in a minute, and you'll feel better about it, I think. All right. What if it's sorted? So we can try voting again, but how is the problem different if it's sorted? If it's sorted, it's in order, and so the thing that's close to 100 is roughly where 100 is in the would be in the list. It may or may not be in the list. So really all we need to figure out is where would 100 be in this sorted list? All right, and we can do that as kind of a lookup. We could do this with what's called binary search. Right? Where would 100 be in this list? Is it in the middle? No, there's a number much bigger than 100 in the middle. So we don't have to care about this half of the list anymore. We can just focus on the first half. All right, let's check the middle element there. Is that bigger or smaller than 100? Oh, it's smaller than 100. Okay, now we can throw away this quarter of the list, and we focus just on this quarter. Each time we check one element of the list, we get to throw away half of what's left. And this can only happen log n times before what we're left with is the number that's closest to 100 in the list. Yeah?
Why wouldn't it just be O of 1 if it's...
Where would you look?
Where 100 is or should be.
But how would you know where it is or should be?
By glancing.
Glancing. So the glancing, if there were really 1,000 numbers lined up and you had no idea what the ranges were, right? They could all be numbers that are between 99 and 100 and 1, or they could be numbers that are between negative 3,000 and 500. You'd have to first kind of check what the range is. You also don't know if they're uniformly distributed. But you're right. I think that you can get a pretty good... You can go there pretty fast. But you wouldn't know exactly where to look. And once you got there, you wouldn't be done yet. You'd have to kind of look again. So there'd be probably a series of jumps. And we can bound the worst case by the log of n. Log of n is actually really small, right? If we have a list of 1,000 elements, that's like a glance. You just glance at most 10 things and probably fewer. All right, I filled that one in for you. All right,
Let's do this one. Median of a sorted list. So remember what a median is. It's the number that would be in the middle, the dead middle, if the list were sorted. But now let's imagine that the list is sorted. How fast can we do this? No, let's do this one. Let's do sorted first. Why? Right in the middle. So if there's 1,000 elements, you just look in the 500th spot. That's where the median lives, if it's sorted. So it's just one, you just look right in the right place. Yeah, so that would be O of 1. Good. All right. But this spot's a little trickier. This is saying we've got an unsorted list. The median is the number that would be in the middle if it were sorted. So what do we do? Well, we talked about one algorithm that you can do by hand that says, take your whole list of numbers and scan through it, find the biggest one and the smallest one, and cross them out. And repeat this over and over and over again. How long is that going to take? Well, finding the biggest and the smallest takes a scan through the entire list. That's O of n. But now you're not done. You actually have to repeat that like n over 2 times. So n over 2 times n, which is like n squared, right? N squared over 2, n squared. So one of these things that matches this one. Look at all pairs, or look through the whole list n times. We're basically looking through the whole list n times to get the median. Okay? So this one's better. O of 1 is better than n squared. Log n is much better than n. So far, a sorted list is winning in these cases. Can anybody think of a better way to do this? You can do better than n squared. And if it helps, I'll give you a hint. It was in there's a hint in the video, the gambler song that I did, the sorters.
Alone to drink?
No, you can forget that one. The one where they're sorting cards. You see that one?
N log n.
Well, so what's the approach? What do you do? So you have this unsorted list. What's the first thing you do?
Find the middle point.
Yeah, but you don't. Oh, I see.
Pick any number, I guess, as the middle point.
Right.
And then throw half of it away.
Right. Interesting.
That's what I got.
That's clever. No, that's actually what you. If you follow that idea through and you really think it through, you end up with O of n.
Really?
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. That finding the median of a list in O of n is actually pretty incredible. But that's not what I was going for. I was actually thinking of something that was a little more. A little more, not direct, but a little more using of the information that we actually had. Like not inventing a new algorithm, just using the algorithms that we already had. I did see a hand go up. Did anybody want to try to guess this? What would you do as a person, right? If you're trying to find the middle of the list, and it's an unsorted list, and you know that the median is the center of the sorted list, what's the first thing you can do to move towards your goal?
Sort it.
Right. And
if you use quicksort, very good. If you have a list of n elements that's unsorted, you can magically turn it into a sorted list of n elements using quicksort, which runs in n log n. So now, n log n, you have a sorted list. Now we're in this box. One lookup, we have the median, we're done. So you can actually do this in n log n, but it's still not O of 1. You can't beat O of 1. So this is still the winner. All right, is that okay? So, all right, what about finding the most common element in a sorted list? So you've got a list of elements, they're all sorted out in front of you, and you want to find which number is repeated the most often.
In a sorted list?
It's sorted, yeah.
O of 1.
I don't know how to do it in O of 1. I don't think you can do it in O of 1. You basically, so you have this long sorted list of numbers. So like 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3, 4, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 6, 6. Right? So there's it's a sorted list of numbers. There's repeats in it, but we want to know which number is repeated the most. But we can do this just by looking through the list once, right? We can say, all right, hey, there's a 1, there's another 1, there's another 1. We have 3 of these. Here's a 2, there's 2 of those. Here's a 3, there are 4 of those. But we're just going left to right through the list. 1 of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that are the same, and 2 that are the same.
And now, in principle, we could go through one more time and just look at these counts and see which one is biggest. So it's basically one scan through the list, or maybe two, but either way, it's still linear. It's just scan through the list. We're not repeating it n times, we're just repeating it once, or twice. Okay? So we can find the modin of a sorted list, O of n. If it's an unsorted list, I think we're screwed. We end up having to take a number, and to see how many times it's repeated, you have to scan through the entire list. So for each element in the list, you have to scan through the entire list. So what is that? All right, so O of n is better. All right, what about finding the mean of a list? Well, finding the mean means you sum up all the elements and you divide by the number of elements. So what if the list is unsorted? How long does it take to do this? It doesn't matter whether it's sorted or not, but still, what's the running time? What do you fill in here? So you have this list of numbers, sorted or not, maybe it doesn't matter. How do you find the sum of it? Can you just jump to one place in the list and look at that number? But in words, you... Yeah, you have to scan through the list keeping a sum, right? You look at the first one, and you add that to your total. You look at the second one, you add that to your total. You just walk through the list, and for each one in the list, you add it to your total. And when you're done, you've got the total of everything. So that's O of n. And it doesn't matter whether it's sorted or not. Because either way, you have to run through all the elements. There's no shortcut in a sorted list to saying what the total of the elements are. Now, if it's the case that the numbers come from some kind of symmetric distribution or something like that, then the number that's in the middle, the median, might actually be pretty close to the mean, the average. But you don't know that for sure. The only way to really know for sure is to add up everything. Oh, how would a statistician do this? What if you're trying to figure out the average height of Rutgers students, right? So there's n Rutgers students. This algorithm, the algorithm we're talking about, would say, go through every Rutgers student, get the height, add it to my total, and then we'll divide by the number of Rutgers students. But that's not what a statistician would do. What would a statistician do? No. Yeah, but where would they get that information from?
They would use the Quicksort method.
No, they would not use the Quicksort method. Though, you know, I would be flattered if they would, but I don't think they would. That's not no. What statisticians do, or pollsters in general, they don't ask everybody a question, right? They don't look through every element in the list. They take a random sample. Yes, right. And so you can actually get by, if you have a list of n elements, you can actually get by with a constant-sized sample to get very close to the mean. Right. So what a random sample says is, we're just going to grab a couple elements from the list and just add those up and divide by the number of elements that we chose, and that'll give us a very good guess as to what the mean of the whole list is, as long as it's not there's an infinity in one of the cells, right? As long as they're bounded in terms of the range of the numbers, you can get a really good estimate quickly this way. So you can actually compute not the mean, but an approximation of the mean in O of 1. That's pretty cool. But in any case, it still doesn't matter if it's sorted or not. What about the min of an unsorted list? So who votes for O of 1? This is an unsorted list. We're trying to find the smallest element. Log n, O of n, O of n squared, and then didn't vote for any of the above. Okay, interesting. So finding the min of the list, you basically run through the list keeping track of what the smallest one is. So you just run through it once, and at the end of it, you'll know which one's the smallest. So that's O of n. What if it's sorted, though? So O of 1, O of log n, O of n, O of n squared, n log n? Log star n? Yeah, so you can do this in constant time. If this list is sorted, whatever's in the first position of the list is the min. So good. All right, so we went through, we answered 10 questions, but it told us which was the right answer, which was B. Oh, nice. I wasted your time. Well, thanks for letting me do that, though. So the majority of people had to say exactly B. All right, any questions on that? Part of me thinks maybe I should just ask those on the final. Like, not make up a new, because
And the temptation is always to ask you something that you've never seen before, because then you have to really think about it. But you may have to actually think about it, even if it's stuff you have seen before. So maybe that's okay. I had a really interesting meeting at the end of last week, Thursday or Friday of last week. I invited somebody from the psychology department who studies how people learn to come and talk to me about how people learn. And, you know, I was thinking about you guys in particular, but he was speaking very generally. And he was talking about various things that he does in psychology classes to measure how well people are learning from the beginning of the semester to the end of the semester. So it's really very interesting to me. It's amazing how you can get to be, oh, I don't know, like a professor at a major university and never really be told any of this stuff. Like, what sort of things can people actually learn? We just guess. So, but there are people who study this, and I'm trying to learn about this. And one of the things he pointed out that was very surprising to me is you can ask people stuff that you actually told them, and that doesn't that can be just as interesting and just as hard. You don't have to make questions so hard that people end up just guessing. So I found that. So I may use that on the point. All right. This one you may not. This is if you remember from last time, that would be great. I'm not expecting you necessarily to get this exactly right. But what I'd like to do is spend a few minutes talking about how to solve this, because that kind of wraps up the previous lecture. But it would be interesting to see if you actually have already kind of mastered this. So I will give you 3 minutes to kind of work this out. You need a piece of paper, presumably. I will certainly need a piece of paper. So what you need to do is make up the Huffman code for the letters in that word, and then count up how long it would take to write out that word in the code.
I think I got that word from Google. Does anybody know? Is that a person? Do you know that person? No? She's in the news right now, Adriana Lima.
that's roughly the number of people, isn't it? People still working? Need more time? We'll probably get another class. So, all right, so this is now the review from last time. So I'm hoping that this will work. But ask questions as we go. Make sure that you really get this, because then I'm going to put one of these on the homework and one of these on the final, and so you want to know how to do this process. All right, so first step is to take all the letters and count up how many of each one there are. So that's step one. So we've got four A's. One, two, three, four. There's a D. There's an R. There's two I's, because, you know, binocular vision and all that. There's an N. There's an L. And there's an M. All right, there were 11 letters, and let's make sure we got the right count. Oh. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. All right, so there's the 11 letters. Some of them are repeated multiple times. Now what we're going to do is we're going to start making a tree that's going to encode our Huffman code. And we merge together the things that have the smallest counts. So at the moment, we have a whole bunch of ones. So we can take any two of them. You may have differed in terms of which one you chose for me. But I'll choose the D and the M. Okay. We merge them together in part of a tree, and the total count for that piece of the tree is 2. Now, we find the next two smallest things to merge together. We have a 2, but we also have a 1 and a 1 and a 1. We're going to take two of the 1s and merge them. Those are the smallest. So I'll take R and N. R and N. I'm going to merge them together with a count of 2. All right, now what have we got? We've got a group that's a 2, another group that's a 2, one that's a 1, one that's a 2, and one that's a 4. So the smallest 2 is a 2 and a 1. I can choose any of the 2s. I'll choose this one because it's easy to draw. So L with a count of 1 gets merged with this group of 2 to make a new group of 3. All right, now what have we got? We've got a group of 3, a group of 2, a group of 2, and a group of 4. The smallest 2 are the two 2s. So I'm going to merge this 2 and this 2 and get a group of 4. All right, now what do we have? A group of 3, a group of 4, and a group of 4. I merge together any group of 4 with a group of 3. Let's say I'll do the A, which has a count of 4. I'll merge it together with this group of 3 to get a group of 7. Now we're left with a group of 4 and a group of 7, and that's all there is, so we have to merge them together. We get one group, which has size 11. That's good because there were 11 letters. That's what the count should match the number of letters when you're done. So now we've got one single tree, and the total count on the tree is 11. So, all right, remember, now we get the code out. So the way we get the code is we look at the left branches are zeros and the right branches are 1. So the code for I is 0, because it's a left branch, 0. It's a left branch. This is 0, 0. The code for D is 0, 1, 0. The code for M is 0, 1, 1. The Code for R is 1000, 4 bits. The code for N, 1001. L, 101. And A, 11. All right? So now, if we're going to do Adriana Lima, we're going to do all those letters. We need 4 A's, 1 D, 1 R, 2 I's, 1 N, 1 L, and 1 M. The A's have length 2, so we need 8 bits for the A's. The D's, there's 1 D, and it's 3 bits long, so we need 3 bits for all the D's. There's 1 R, and it's 4 bits long, so we need 4 bits for all the R's. 2 I's, and there's 2 bits long, so that's a total of 4 bits for the I's. 1 N, and it's 4 bits long, so we need 4 bits for the N's. 1 L, and it's 3 bits long, so we need 3 bits for the L's. And 1 M, and it's 3 bits long, so we need 3 bits for the M's. Whew. All right, so 8 and 3 is 11, and 4 is 15, and 4 is 19, and 4 is 23, and 3 is 26, and another 3 is 29. So to write out all of Adriana Lima using this code is 29 bits, which is choice A. Thank you. What's interesting is you could actually, at any point when you had a choice and you could merge different things, you get a different code, but you end up with the same total number of bits, which is why that's what I asked you. If I had asked you, what's the code for Adriana Lima, we could have all gotten completely different answers. But there's one right answer in terms of the total number of bits. All right. So what steps did people lose it? What can I review? Go ahead.
I has 2 bits, right?
In this case, with this code, I had 2 bits, 00. Yeah. And there's 2 I's in her name. So each of those is 2 bits. So it's a total of 4 bits to represent the I's in her name. All right. Do you want to try one of those, or do you want to ask any more questions about this one? What would be most useful? Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, these numbers, wait, which numbers?
Like where you just
there's said. This line of numbers.
No, the other numbers.
This line is, so there's the letter A has a code here that's 2 bits long. 1-1 is how we're representing A. So 2 bits for each A. Her name has 4 A's in it. So the total number of bits allocated from the A's in her name is 8, 4 times 2. So we're multiplying the frequency of the letter times the number of bits in the code for that letter. And then we add them up. So, you know, like maybe try Mississippi later, right? You'll see that the I is going to get a really short code, right? M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I, right? All those I's are going to be really short so that it can actually represent Mississippi in as few bits as possible. Okay? So I guess if you're okay with this, we'll just move on. I'll do another clicker question on this next time just to make sure that you can practice it enough and ask questions and feel comfortable with it. All right? You good? Okay then, moving on. Woo-hoo. All right, so chapter 7 in the book is actually about parallel computers. And so what I'd like to do is give you a quick intro to why we have parallel computers and why the author of the book was so interested in them. And what are some various things that we can do with them that's better. I just learned, actually, just maybe 2 weeks ago from somebody in my department that parallel computers are back. They're like the next big thing in computers. So I didn't know that. But they were very popular when I was an undergrad. And they got really popular, and then they got completely unpopular. But now apparently the pendulum is swinging back. So let's talk about what these are and why we should care. So back to computers is a good thing. The more sorts of things that we ask our computers to do for us, the more we would like them to do it quickly so we can get on with our lives. And what's been nice is that computer engineers have been working for the last 50 years to satisfy our need for speed. Every couple of years, computers are faster and more sophisticated, more complete than they were the years before. So that's been a good thing. And in fact, people have noticed this and actually been pretty amazed by it. The first guy who really pointed this out and popularized it was a guy named Moore, Moore Speed. And he worked for Intel, the chip maker,
And he helped them kind of help guide them towards faster and faster chips that they were making. But what's amazing, if you just look at, these are just chips made by the company Intel from 1970 to 2005. On this axis is the year, like, you know, straight up, just the, you know, the year that they were introduced in blocks of five. And on the other axis is the number of transistors that they fit on a chip. More transistors means more processing, generally means more speed. So in 1970, they introduced a processor, a computer chip called the 4004. And that had just a couple, was a little bit more than 1,000 transistors on it, which at the time was pretty awesome. The Pentium, and Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, up to the Itiniums? I don't know what those are. Up on the order of a billion transistors, getting close to a billion transistors. So on this axis is the number of transistors, but it's on a log scale, right? So log scale means that if you have a line on a plot like this, where it's linear in this scale and log on the other scale, that's exponential growth. And what you're seeing here is that every year and a half, the number of transistors doubles. And it's been going on, not just since 1970, but actually even before that. There were not really a lot of computers before that, but nevertheless, it's been this incredibly consistent increase in speed. But here's the thing. In our lifetimes, this will end. And here's why. The fundamental limit on computation is this notion of the cycle. So if you remember back when we talked about computer architecture, we talked about putting circuits on together to try to build a computer, what's happening is that there's this cycle that happens, that there's an instruction, the data is in a certain form, and an instruction gets carried out, which changes the data in some way, and then it gets copied over, and it happens again. And the example that I showed you in class was with Christmas lights, but that's what all computers are doing. They're taking data, and they're just recycling it. And each time it cycles through, you can do one operation, one change to the data. And the cycle time at the moment is about a nanosecond. Okay? Which I forget what that is. What's a nanosecond? It's like a billionth of a second, I think? That sound right? And so this cycle is repeated a billion times every second. So that's about where computers are now. Information travels at the speed of light, which turns out to be about a foot per nanosecond. So a nanosecond is the time that it takes light to go from this finger to this finger, which is pretty amazing. We're talking about very fast speeds, but we're talking about the kinds of speeds that computers can actually reach right now. But it takes about a nanosecond for light to get from one end to the other. But information in the chip is traveling at the speed of light. So in one nanosecond, information can only travel this far. Now, computer chips are about this big. So you can't get that much faster than a nanosecond per cycle time because the information has to travel in actual physical space. So the smaller the chip is, the shorter you can get the cycle time. But once things get really, really, really tiny, quantum randomness starts to dominate the signal. So bits are actually electrical signals, but we're talking about things that are so, so, so tiny now that it's at the level of, you know, subatomic effects. And quantum randomness just takes over, and basically a bit can be a 1 in 1 second, it could be a 0 in another second, it just keeps changing. You can't get a consistent mapping because matter doesn't work the same at that scale. So if you just project forward a bit, the fundamental limit of how fast we can make computers is actually going to be hit around 2010 or 2020, somewhere in that decade. And at that point, they just won't be able to put transistors any closer together before they start to just not function properly anymore. So that's interesting. Now, you think in 2010 or 2020 we're going to be tired of computers and we won't need them to be any faster? Probably not. Yeah, what are you thinking?
Like, how many chips are in like a basic computer?
So the main processing is actually just one chip.
Just one chip?
Yeah, but you can have separate chips for things like memory and sometimes like a graphics card for doing separate off-board processing. But the main brain is one chip.
And they're this big.
And they're this like an inch maybe. Yeah.
Wouldn't more chips?
But what are those other chips going to do? So that's what this is about. So yeah, so maybe we can get bigger, more sophisticated computers, not by making the one chip that we have smaller and smaller and smaller, because at some point that just doesn't work anymore, but by just having more chips. So the basic idea here is, it's like, you know the expression, many hands make light work? So maybe we can, instead of having one computer getting faster and faster and faster, we can have a whole bunch of computers that are all some fixed amount of speed, but the more computers we put in, the more processors we put in, the faster the work will get done. So that's a nice idea, but it turns out that it's not exactly trivial to get all the benefits of this idea. So what I'd like to do is give you a sense of what sort of things are actually easy to do when you have lots of computers working together, and which things seem to be fundamentally not easier to do as you get more computers. So to give you a sense of what people have done in the past with having lots and lots of computers working together, here's a guy named Philip Amigwali, and he won the Gordon Bell Prize for Supercomputing in 1989 by using this computer that's behind him in the picture. So you see this computer here? It's actually, it was very cool looking. It's still very cool looking. It was like eight black cubes stuck together in a pattern. And inside that, we're all working together. We're 65,000 separate processors. 65,000 computers all working together in this box. And of course, they had to install the red LED blinky lights on it, so it looked very war games. It was a wicked cool computer. I worked for that company a bit. And this was the computer was designed by Hillis, the guy who wrote our book, as part of his PhD dissertation. He said, oh, there's going to be lots of things that we want to do, like vision processing, things that we just need lots of computers working together. Here's how you can do it. And he worked this out. He graduated. He formed a company. They manufactured this computer. They cost like, you know, $2 to $4 billion a pop. And they lasted for a couple years, and then they went out of business. But anyway, it was a very cool idea, and there was lots of interesting things you could do to think about how you'd use it. So what this guy did is he figured out how to use the connection machine to do fluid dynamics. So fluid dynamics is this idea of, imagine you've got like water flowing past the hull of a boat, or air flowing across a wing. Just basically a medium that's moving and an object that's being moved around. The best way that people know how to figure out what would happen if you put, you know, a hole into a water is by simulating the water moving around the hull. And so what he did is he actually got the computer to do 3.1 billion operations per second to do this fluid dynamics calculation. And that won him this big prize. So that was pretty amazing at the time. There was nothing like it at the time. However, project forward now a couple of years. So we're now about 17 years past 1989, maybe a little bit more than that. And because computer speed doubles every year and a half, that's been 11 doublings. Or in other words, a 2,000-fold increase in how powerful processors are. So now you can actually get, or at least a year or so ago, you could get a Mac G5, which is a single computer that you could buy at the Short Hills Mall, that would do 2.5 billion operations per second, which is almost as good as what he was getting with his million-dollar processor and his highfalutin degrees and stuff like that. Right? So he worked his butt off and won an award for getting 3.1 operations per second. You can now go to the mall and get something that can do 2.5 billion operations per second. So it's not that he was actually that smart, he was just ahead of his time. He was pretty smart, actually. But my point is that sometimes to solve a really, really hard problem, the best way to do it is you wait 17 years until computers are much faster, and then you can solve it in a day. Which is very weird. Alright, so one of the reasons that thinking machines went out of business, the company that made the connection machine out of business, is because they had to design this 65,000 processor computer so carefully, and it was so complicated, that people who were working on single chip computers were getting, each year and a half, they were doubling their speed, and the connection machine wasn't getting any faster. And so they just got outpaced. It was also way too expensive. But this idea of having lots of computers working together didn't die. This is still a great idea, and in fact, this is basically what Google's doing. Google has the history's largest supercomputer, if you think about it. They won't tell anybody how many computers they actually have working for them, but some people have estimated, based on the financial information that was released when they went IPO, they had to talk about financials, how much they spend on different categories of items. You can make some guesstimates as to how many computers they have. It might be about 300,000 computers that all work together to be Google, the Google that we use when we type stuff into the search engine. Maybe it's 100,000. Maybe it's more. Unclear. But still, we're talking about really fast computers, much faster than they were at the time of when the connection machine was built, and we're talking about way more of them, distributed all over the world. So these computers are a lot more powerful than those on the connection machine, and there's a lot more of them. We're talking about major computational power. So if you have more computers, that means we can do everything faster, right? Not exactly. So let's do the following thought experiment. So J.K. Rowling wrote a bunch of books, I'm told. And it took her about 2 years to write the last of the Harry Potter books. So imagine you're a publisher and you're like, okay, people are waiting for this book, we're gonna make a lot of money when this book comes out. The sooner we get it out, the sooner we start getting that money. So here's what we're gonna do. Instead of having one author work for 2 years, let's hire 600 authors, and then they should be able to do it in a day, right? I can imagine someone thinking that. It's a dumb thought, though, right? Sure, 600 authors times the number of hours in a day is roughly, that product is roughly what J.K. Rowling spent. But having it be one person actually is very important in this case. The reason is you can't just divide up the task of writing something like a book, where everything's supposed to hang together nicely, by the number of workers, and the number of workers. And then everyone should be able to work at the same speed as they were. The problem is coordination. The problem is, sure, you could get 600 authors to write that 1/600th of a book, but when you go to read that book, it won't make any sense, right? It'd be like, oh, author one, author two is now talking about something completely different. Oh, author three now. Wait, the style's not even the same anymore. You need to actually coordinate information between all those so that the end product hangs together and makes sense. And so now this gets at the key issue in parallel computation. If you have a problem that you can break up and doesn't require a lot of coordination, you can get tremendous benefits from having multiple computers working at it at the same time. But if you're talking about a problem where everything needs to be very tightly coordinated, you can throw lots of computers at it, but they're all going to be waiting, except for one. All the work is going to really be happening in one of the computers. So you can't always just take a problem and divide it up and expect it to get done faster. So another concrete example like this, in case you didn't get the author example. So imagine there's two ways you can think about getting a whole bunch of people to work together to paint a fence. So how can we do it? So one way is, we've got, you know, four subtasks. We've got to open paint cans, we got to prepare the surfaces so that they're ready to take the paint, then you actually apply the paint, and then you have to clean the brushes when you're done while the thing is drying. All right. So there's kind of these four subtasks that you have to do. So how can you get a benefit from having multiple people working together? How can you get this fence painted quickly? So one way to do it is you say, all right, we've got four subtasks. We'll just assign a person to each subtask. We'll have one person be in charge of opening the paint cans, one person in charge of preparing the surfaces, and maybe we can even do those two things at the same time, one person applying the paint, which we can only do after the first two people are done, and then the last person cleaning the brushes, which we can only do after the third person's done. So we've got these four people. In the beginning, these two people are just waiting, doing nothing. The first two people are working together, getting things ready. Then they're done, and they don't have anything to do anymore while person three works. Then when person three is done, then person four can start. So how much faster does this get done than just letting one person do it? Not very much. In fact, it's maybe instead of taking four steps, maybe you can get it done in three steps. But it's not like if we throw 1,000 people at it, it's going to get done any sooner because they're all going to be waiting. So this is a bad way of taking this problem and structuring it so you can get it done in parallel. But there's a better way. What if we did this? What if we gave everybody a can of paint, a sander to prepare surfaces, a section of the fence, and stuff for cleaning the brushes? And now everyone's in charge of doing all four steps, but they're doing it on different sections of the fence. So now instead of breaking up the problem by tasks, everyone's got the same task, but you break it up by the data, by the thing that you have to work on. So Hillish says that you can call these two kinds of parallel structuring. The first one is instruction parallelism. Different instructions are executed in parallel on the same data. The second kind he calls data parallelism, which is different parts of the data, different parts of the fence, are being worked on in parallel. The same thing's being done to them, but there's different people doing the doing. Okay? Does that sort of make sense? Modulo me saying it badly. Right? So that's what, you know, if you try to clean up after a party, you don't have one person in charge of the broom and one person in charge of the dustpan. You try to break it up by rooms or something like that. Break it up by surfaces on the floor and have everybody working at the same time. You can get the whole thing done. The more people you have, the faster it's going to get done. Whereas if you break it up by tasks, you can throw more people at it and it's not going to result in any improvements. All right, so now you need to do a demo with everybody. Wake up. And here's what I'd like to do. I want you to raise your hand if you have a telephone number that has two or more fives in it. All right, thank you. All right, does anyone have a telephone number that has three or more fives in it? Really? How many? Just three, or is it just all fives all the way across? Three fives, yeah?
Three.
And you have three fives as well. All right, so here's what I want you to notice. I want you to notice the difference of how fast that went compared to if we had to do it this way. That I would have to do this all by myself. You write down all your phone numbers, you give them to me, and I go through the list, and for each number in the list, I say, does this have three fives? Does this have three fives? Does this have three? That would take a while, and as the number of people in the class gets larger, it's going to grow like O of N. It's going to grow like the number of people in the class. But on the other hand, when I asked you guys to do the work, I basically had each of you working on your own phone number, which you did very fast, and then you put up your hand, and I could just with a glance see which hands are up or whether there's no hands up, and I could solve this problem, or we as a group could solve this problem much faster. And in fact, it won't scale with the number of people, it won't scale badly with the number of people. If we doubled the size of the class, we'd still get the answer in about the same amount of time. So that's a very powerful example of how we can take advantage of multiple workers, multiple processors. So the sequential approach, if we only had one processor, and all you guys were just data, then it would have been like big O of N. If we're going to do this other idea, then it takes sort of like log N, maybe, so essentially a constant. Depends how quickly we get OR. Because basically everybody was saying yes or no, and then I had to very quickly compute an OR over all the hands. Which was easy, because the visual system is very good at that sort of thing. So this is a really simple example, but it actually tells you the two key operations that these giant parallel processors, including Google, do. And they're called map and reduce. So map is the idea that I can assign, or the, there can be a main processor and then subordinate processors. In this case, I get to be the main processor. Other days, you could be the main processor. But in this case, you were being the subordinate processor, and I was able to then, you had your own data, and I was able to give you a function, which I could say in words, because you're people, saying, apply this function to your data. So I took this function, and I had you map it into the data that you had. So that was the first step. And the second step was a reduce. A reduce lets you summarize the results. So in this case, what I wanted to do is anybody in that category, or how many people are in that category? I could calculate that based on the number of hands that went up. So there was a map operation where I tell you all what to do with your data, and then there's a reduce operation where all this information, a summary of this information comes back to me, and now I have the answer. Map and reduce. And this is almost all the key big computations that Google does are expressed in terms of map. They send it out to their many computers, they get their answers, and they pull them back together. So here's one thing that they actually do with their MapReduce system. They have a thing that they call Hot Trends. Has anybody played with this? It's available. You can just click it from Google. But it's very cute. And what they're doing is they're actually taking, they get millions of queries every day. They don't actually, again, they don't tell us exactly how many they have, but it's on the order of millions of queries every day. And some queries are happening all the time. So apparently people are search for the word weather very often. And there's certain like female actresses that get searched for a lot, for whatever reason. But some of these queries are happening more often, the speed with which they're being sent to Google changes over time. And so what Hot Trends does is it tries to figure out of all the queries that are getting, which ones are starting to happen more often than they had in the past. Which ones had been going along at a very low rate, and then all of a sudden they start to spike up. If they spike up, then maybe there's some kind of trend, there's some kind of important event happening around that search term. And so what they do is, I think they change this every hour, so you can go and watch this if you're really bored. They give you the top 100 the queries, the top 100 queries that are changing in popularity, that are going from being unpopular to suddenly shooting up and becoming popular. So I did this last night, and I took the top 10, and these were what they were. Harris Poll, BCS Selection Show, Sam Horrigan, Harris Poll College Football, Dimitri Martin, Parade.com, Music City Bowl, Las Vegas Marathon, Brink, and Jennifer Love Hewitt, Hawaii. Does anybody know why any of these suddenly became popular? Right? Something happened between like yesterday and today that suddenly these search terms shot up in popularity. You know what it is? Like Harris Poll?
Standings came out of this.
Yeah, all right. So these are football things, right? Like college football. So that's number one, number two, and number four are all the same thing. The standing came out. Suddenly everybody wanted to know what was going on. They wanted to get the latest news on it. Sam Horrigan? You know about Sam Horrigan? I had to look all these up because I had no idea what was going on. This is the plot for Sam Horrigan. If you click in Google Trends, if you click on the search terms that are popular, they actually show you the graph. So this is like yesterday, 6 p.m., like nobody's searching for Sam Oregon, nobody. And then somewhere around 8 in the morning, all of a sudden, or this is, I guess, this is like 11 o'clock our time, this is Pacific time, suddenly people are searching for Sam Oregon, a lot. So what happened? Who is this guy and why? I actually looked this up and now I don't remember what it is. I want to say that it was like a reality show thing. Like he's a contestant on a reality show and something significant happened. Damn, I prepared for this and now I forgot. Dimitri Martin? Do people know who Dimitri Martin is? Yes? He's a very funny guy. Why did he suddenly become a popular search term? Does anybody know? Apparently he's just been, it's been announced that he's getting his own show. So people are like, oh, he's getting, who's this guy? And they search for him. So he shot up. His graph looks a lot like this. Parade.com, I don't remember what that is. Music City Bowl. Las Vegas Marathon is happening around now. Or actually just finished, so it's the results are out. Brink? Anybody know what that is?
Are these just pieces of search queries or
no.
The actual search?
I think they're actual search queries and they kind of pool them together. So they take search queries that are all related to each other and they sum up the counts for them. It's not Brink, it's not the word Brink, like, whoa, it's something else. I forget what it was. But I did look up Jennifer Love Hewitt in Hawaii. Does anybody know what that's about? Yeah, go ahead.
She had like unflattering pictures of her.
Yeah, she went on vacation in Hawaii and apparently she's, instead of being 100 times smaller than a normal person, she's now only 50 times smaller than a normal person. And so everybody said she doubled her weight. All life as we know it will cease to exist. So there's this whole big thing going on about Jennifer Love Hewitt's weight. And so people are searching for that. They want to see the pictures, I think, mainly. So anyway, so this is what was hot yesterday. To make this very simple little plot, which has some interest in it, they actually have to a program that has to go sift through all the queries, count up how often they're happening, compare that to how often they've been happening in the recent past, and see which ones are kind of spiking up. And so this is actually a very complicated thing to do when you've got a million queries per day. And so they do this all with parallel computation and MapReduce. They take all the queries in, they give them out to a whole bunch of different computers, they have each computer do some of their own statistics, they pool them together with a reduce operation, the subresults they send back out, they do this a couple times to do what they have to do. The 20 terabyte index that is Google, they have to do about 5 to 10 MapReduce operations to prepare this. It's pretty slick stuff. All right, so what I'd like to do, it looks like we're getting close to the end of class time. So I'm going to do one more demo. Let me see how many slides I have here. Okay, I'll save this for next time. There's cool image stuff that I want to share with you. So let me get up to that point, and then we'll stop there. So here's what I'd like to do. Everybody needs to think of the first digit of your phone number. Okay, so a little before I asked you how many fives were in your phone number, take that phone number, take the first digit of that phone number, just hold it in your head for a second. Okay? Skip the area code. Otherwise, maybe we'll all have more or less the same number. All right, so now I want everyone to raise your hand. Okay, now find, I want everybody has to pair up. So two people that have your hands up, identify each other. If you can't find someone, that's okay, you'll go in the next round. But try to find someone nearby. And exchange numbers, sum them up, and then one person put your hand down. The other person, keep your hand up and know the sum. So basically, one person should be giving your number to the other person to make the sum. All right? So now we should have about half as many hands up. Does anybody need another minute to add their two one-digit numbers? Are we good? All right. Now we're going to...
The whole phone number you want us to add?
No, just the first digit. I didn't want to like kill your addition skills. Everybody should have a one-digit number to start. You're going to add that with someone near you. And so now, and then one hand goes down, the other person remember the sum of those two digits. All right? You good? So who's your hands down? Your hand should either be up, or the number that you had should be added to somebody else's. And that person's hand should be up. Otherwise, your number is going away. We're trying to get the sum of all the numbers. All right? Now let's repeat. Two people with hands up, exchange numbers, sum them, and one person's hand goes down.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I appreciate it so much.
All right?
We have to ask something.
All right?
Yeah.
We good? Okay, repeat one more time. So two people, only people with their hands up, pair up, exchange numbers, one person goes down, the other person remembers the sum.
Yes.
All right? There's only a couple left. All right? We're going to repeat again. Pair up.
Okay.
Either receive or send a number with someone else.
All right.
38.
All right. Oh, we still, okay, we still got three left.
We have to change with the three people. So,
so with three, we can't pair them up. So insert can just stay, and you guys pair up.
Wait, were we supposed to add again?
Each time when your hand stays up, it's because you consumed the number from the other person and added it to your total.
So you added the first one, and then we added the second one.
Yeah, you should keep adding. You always remember the sum.
So then,
just pretend. 21. Okay, great. All right, so now you guys have your sums?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
All right, why don't you pass it up?
64.
And that's the total of everything, everything?
Yeah,
did you add an insert number?
Well,
here's
the what again?
64. Ooh, power two. All right. So here's supposedly what happened. I can't actually check this. Tell me what the total was.
152.
And we have about 40 people doing numbers. It should be like close to 200 if the numbers are evenly distributed. 150. So a little low. I think some numbers did get lost in this process. But nevertheless, thank you. So here's what we just did. We started off with 40 numbers. And I can add these all up with an O of N algorithm where I just ask each person one at a time for your number and I keep a total. But instead, I had you guys do the work. So you paired up. So initially there's 40, let's say 40 numbers. Then after the first round, everybody's paired up and now only 20 hands are left. Then we put the hand, then we add, pair up and add again, and now only 10 hands are left. Then we do it again, and only 5 hands are left. And again, 3, yeah, and then 2, and then 1, and we're done. So how many times did we have to do this until we got down to the one answer? So in this case, if it was 40, it was something like 6 times we had to do it. But in general, if we have N people, say we have 1,000 people, instead of going through all 1,000 people, if we just keep doing this pairing thing, it only takes 10 rounds of pairings before we get the total. So what we're doing is taking advantage of parallelism to go from O of N to sum up the list. This is when things are sequential. We do just, I have to do all the work. But in the parallel case, it's however many times, whatever N was, how many times do we have to divide it in half before we get down to the answer? So what is that? That's O of... So how many times can you divide N in half before you get down to 1?
Log N.
I hear 1 log N. Anybody else like log N? Who likes log N? It's log N. Yeah, so that's what log N is. Log N is the number of times you can divide N in half before you get down to 1. And that's what we did. We just kept halving the class, halving the number of people who had their hands up until we got down to the last person with the answer. And that gave us the total. So the number of rounds, the amount of time that it took was proportional to the logarithm of the number of people instead of the number of people. So we got a big bonus out of doing it that way. Alright, so that's it. Okay. And there's lots of other really good examples where you can just give out all the work and do this in parallel. And what I'm going to do next time is give you a concrete example of this where you can do it with computer graphics where each processor corresponds to one pixel on the screen. That'll be next time. And what are you supposed to remember for the final? What's the magic word? That's right. And you can't help smiling when you say it. Hey. I was letting mine secure that I can return the answer. So,
Hmm.